Okay. Meeting will come to order. Yes. The first order of business before us is Representative Huntley's bill.
Okay.
Representative Huntley. I'll move that, unless there's someone else who wants. I'll move House File 0163. The recommend is to pass, and I guess it goes back to finance, does it? Is that, how do we do things?
My understanding it goes to the overall finance committee.
Okay.
They do what they want with it.
Someone's saying yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I make that motion. Okay. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and members, this is a bill that allows the city of Duluth to fix some problems that it has. The major one is we have a unfunded obligation to retirees for health care, and it's been estimated that this unfunded liability is about $300 million. With that in perspective, the city budget is about $78 million a year, so that this is a huge problem. Duluth is not alone with this problem. It's been legislative auditor has actually issued a report in the last month describing this problem across the state. Many local units of government have similar problems. Some are even worse than Duluth's. Some aren't as bad. So how is the city going to deal with this problem? What they want to do is start putting money aside so that when this bill really becomes due, that they will have money there. Under current state law, the only thing that cities can do with investments is put it into really low-yield investments that might yield 4.5%. What this would do is allow the city to invest money in the state with the State Investment Board, hopefully to get a higher rate of return in the order of 10%. And that means that the unfunded liability of $300 million is cut more than half, down to about $140,000, so $140 million. And so it makes a huge difference to the city. Currently, they're not allowed to do that by law. This would allow them to this bill allows them to do two things, but I'm going to focus at first on the first one, which is called an irrevocable trust fund. Federal law has changed. The cities are now required to put on their books all these unfunded obligations, and the city of Duluth, after 20-some years of doing nothing about this problem under our current mayor, has decided it's time for us to actually take some action. So they would like to put some money aside, put it in a high interest account, and hopefully then when these retirement benefits come due, that there will be sufficient money there to do that. The accounting says it has to be an irrevocable trust fund, which we're not allowed to do currently. And that means that the money that goes in there can only be used for that specific purpose. So if we're going to withdraw money, it has to be used on these retirees' health benefits. And that means that somebody's got to look at those when money comes out of the fund. Somebody has to oversee that it's actually going to where it's supposed to go. And that's why there are two units of state government involved. One is the Public Employees Retirement Association, which will monitor and see that the money that comes out of this fund actually goes where it's supposed to go. And secondly, there's the State Board of Investment that will actually invest the money and hopefully make a profit for the city. The other thing in this bill, sort of separate from that, is to set up another account, which is not an irrevocable one. It simply lets the city put some of its money into the State Board of Investment, get a higher rate of interest, and use it for whatever they want. And that does not require PARA because there's no real need the city puts the money in this other account, they can take it out and spend it for whatever cities need to spend it on. But the so that's why this is sort of complicated. There's the para part of this bill that oversees the irrevocable trust fund, and then there's the other fund, and both of those two funds would be, however, managed by the State Board of Investment. And with that, I turn it over to either the mayor or Jeannie Stark, who is the city finance chief, city finance director.
Mayor Burtson.
Madam Chairman and committee members, we began tackling this problem about 3 years ago, and last year actually had a bill that received quite a bit of support both in the Senate and the House, but unfortunately didn't pass. The version of the bill that you see today is an even better form of the bill than what we had last year, and it's one that we believe can allow the city to climb out of this serious problem without costing the state a penny. I sincerely cannot believe that there will be other entities, cities, counties, and school districts in the state that are going to be able to resolve the problem themselves. We want to resolve it ourselves. There are three main components to this bill that we need your help with. The first component is a law that creates and the ability to deposit money in an irrevocable trust. GASB 45 requires that we identify what our obligation is. We will be opening up the fund by depositing $10 million from a fund that we have that is presently used as an interest-bearing account to pay for street bonds. And also adding roughly $2 million from our fund balance in our health care fund balance account. Right now, I mentioned that Community Investment Trust Fund, the endowment fund that is used to pay for street bonds, the balance of that fund is about $60 million. If we draw $10 million from it, the balance will be $50 million. Therefore, we've reduced our ability to pay for those street bonds by reducing the amount of principal, therefore we get less interest. If we're allowed to invest that $50 million in a more aggressive fashion, we make up for that loss. So one doesn't work without the other. If we take $10 million out of that street bond interest-bearing account, we need to replace the loss of revenue somehow, and the way you can help us replace it is by allowing us to invest it in a revocable trust fund, therefore realizing more dollars to pay for those street improvements that we've got bonds out for as much as 9 years now. So you have our pledge that we are going to get this defined benefit out of contracts for future hires. We just recently reached an agreement with one union, and this evening our city council will vote to ratify a second agreement with firefighters. We have three other unions, and we have stood firm and will not at any point offer a defined benefit to any employees in the future. It will be a defined contribution, and people just have to understand that we cannot afford to go down this road any longer. I'll just close by saying I don't think it's very often that you have the unanimous support of the city council and administration and the citizens, chamber of commerce, the unions, everyone in the city has a number one priority, and it doesn't cost the state a penny. It's rare that that would happen, but it has in this case. This is our number one legislative priority, and at least from a state perspective, it isn't going to cost you even a cent. So we would appreciate your questions, and we'll stand for them, and we really need your help here. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to say something too? Say you are.
I would just. I'm Jeannie Stark, the finance director for the city of Duluth, and what the mayor has said. This is all something that has come about from a change in accounting rules, and we have a plan. In addition to the initial funding the mayor mentioned, The City Council has already approved a rate increase which will put an additional $2 million a year into this trust fund if we can set it up. And when a couple of our bigger TIF districts come offline, we are planning on dedicating the city's portion of those property taxes to go in there annually to build this up. Just to give you an idea of the change, the $300 million number that you've been hearing, which is our liability, if we can earn a higher rate of interest with the State Board of Investment, our liability is estimated to be about $150 million. And so that's a significant change. In addition to a defined benefit plan changing to a defined contribution plan, current employees are also agreeing to take a higher deductible copay insurance plan and give up on the fully insured plan that they have now. If you have any questions for any of us, we'd be happy to answer. And we also have Mary Vanek, the Executive Director of PARA here, and Howard Bicker, the Executive Director of the State Board of Investment, and they both support our initiative on this. Thank you.
Are there any? First of all, thank you for this. Whoever did this, it's terrific. First thing I've been able to really understand about it. So I think this is just, this is really very helpful for all of the members. We've been discussing this for a couple of days or so, and so we do have some amendments, and I think the amendments are pretty much all agreed on as such. There's one, I had raised a question about PERA's involvement in this. And at one point I had an amendment prepared to take PERA out of it. I'm not, that amendment I understand would have been opposed, and I'm not offering that amendment, although I would still like to ask PERA, maybe when we get to the final bill, I would like to ask them some questions. But I would like to have a set of amendments, and I know that the author's seen them. I don't know if the, I assumed he was responsible for showing them to the people from Duluth. So when I say they're agreed on, I hope that that's true. And I'll just start with the amendments. One thing that I'm a little are there any? I don't want to interrupt any questions of the people at the table. If there are questions of the people at the table, or if we want to amend the bill first. And there's a quorum being present, so actually Representative Swigum moves adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Oh. Still passes. Motion passes anyway. Okay. We'll start with these amendments, get the bill in the shape which I believe the author has agreed to, and then we can have further discussion if we need to. First amendment I'd like to do is Amendment 2A. And one of the things I'm a little concerned about with fast-tracking what may be very significant legislation and not, you know, I hope we've spent long enough on it, but looking at the puzzled eyes of some people who have looked at this piece of legislation or who have I've asked to have comments on and haven't been able to get back to me, I'd like to make even though I understand the necessity of doing this really fast, I'd like to see that we don't stumble on it later. So this language that I'd like proposed to add is an intent and purpose, that this isn't going to set a precedent for other things that we're going to do on along this line. And it may be the most perfect solution that we have, but I'd like us, I don't want somebody coming in at some point when we're really disagreeing with it and said, but you did it for Duluth, you have to do it for us. So I'd like to move that 2A amendment, and I believe it's acceptable to Duluth and the author.
Madam Chair, members, this is acceptable to us. We're not opposing it, one of the reasons this bill is moving along faster than the general one is that our obligation is increasing by $34,000 a day.
Right. So I'm more comfortable moving it faster with this little back up behind it. Any discussion of the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, another amendment. This is the issue, it's amazing how much you get to learn when you start to look at a bill like this. This is the issue which was pointed out that the bill did not require local approval. It was a specific bill and it didn't require local approval. So then I learned, which maybe all of you guys on this committee knew besides me, is that there are actually two sections in statute about local approval, one of which seems to require local approval for a special law for one city, and one of which seems to say you don't need local approval for a special law for a city. So in discussions with Mark Shepard and looking at the two pieces, and apparently Duluth had looked at one and our pension commission staff had looked at the other, when I looked at both, I couldn't figure out the difference. Mark Shepard explained the difference between the two sections. One is kind of a requirement and the other is kind of an enablement. And the more gentle one doesn't require local approval and the stronger one does. The Duluth has no objection. They really have to go through a process anyway to do these things, so they have no objection to the local approval clause being on it. So we've added the local approval clause. And if it was going to impede anything, we wouldn't, but everyone says it's okay, so I just assume put it on. Again, Representative Anderson?
So, Representative Kahn, this, all this is saying is the City Council, is it the voters in the City of Duluth?
City Council.
Just the City Council.
And they have no problems with it. Is there any discussion of the 3A amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, we now have an A2 as opposed to a 2A amendment. This is a totally technical amendment. This is apparently just cleanup language, and I guess thanks to the city, we submitted a longer amendment that was supposed to be just cleanup language, and thanks to the staff, to the people representing the City of Duluth, they helped us clean up the cleanup language. So I now think the cleanup language is truly technical cleanup language, and I think people
again, Madam Chair, we support this amendment.
Okay. I'll move the A2 amendment as opposed to the 2A amendment, which we did earlier. But all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Okay, there's one more, and I apologize, Representative Huntley. I didn't show you this amendment because it was only just prepared, so immediately give it to the people up there, and then we'll pass it. This follows up some of the things that I'd like to see the committee doing a little more of. And the only reason I'm bringing it in here is because this is the first bill dealing with this before us. And this is an additional rate of return analysis. And I'd like an annual report by the State Board of Investment for the on the specific return of the fund of this investment performance analysis for the investments that this is going to be. I think this follows on some of the things that we talked about at our last meeting about the kind of decisions that are made about investments. And this is Duluth doesn't have to do anything. Duluth doesn't have to do anything about this. It's requiring a little bit more from the State Board of Investment, but, I would like to see us requiring this more and more, and I think this is the first case of trying to do this. And this, Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at lines 11 and 12 on the 5A amendment, and specifically the phrase, with the rates of return that it could have achieved in investments in the applicable indices combined in a manner that adjusts for the board's actual portfolio mix.
Yes.
This is a question of the uninitiated. I know what an index would be, but yes. How does that, could you please explain the adjustment?
This is the issue, this is the point where you, where you use, so you have several, you'll have a, probably should have someone who can do this better than me, but let me try it, because that might be. You've got, for example, a stock index, and you've got a bond index fund, a standard index fund, and I think the State Board of Investment picks out funds which they look at. So you then, in the actual portfolio mix, you then say it's going to be 70% stock. This is supposed to be aggressive, so it'll probably be a pretty high stock percentage and 30% bond. So then the actual mix is what depends on the return that you're going to look at.
And Madam Chair, so the comparison here would be similar to the policy comparison that Mr. Stolte
yes.
discussed at our meeting, our last meeting?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Madam Chair, did you and counsel hear from Mr. Bicker about
sure.
this amendment?
Yeah. Yeah. Do people from Duluth have any comments on it, or did you just want?
Just that,
really doesn't.
Madam Chairman and committee, just an interesting addition is that we didn't get this bill last year, but I was recently told that we could have achieved as high an interest rate as 14% if it had been created last year. So it's just another reason to urge you to please help us move things along.
Right. Well, we're intending to. And we actually want to then, besides moving it around, we also want to look at it as an example that might help us with looking at other investment decisions we're going to look at. Mr. Bicker?
Madam Chair and members, State Board of Investment already does do a return of comparative indices versus the return of each individual organization that we invest money for. The one issue you're going to have here is the State Board of Investment does not choose the asset mix Duluth chooses.
Okay.
Duluth will choose the asset mix, the State Board of Investment will not. And obviously there'll be some cash flow ramifications, but we always report our returns we have for 30 years versus indices, and we will continue to report our returns.
I think the only thing we're trying to do is make sure, since we've had this before us, that we're specifically looking at what's happening in this case. I know. I get your report. And I look at your report, and I try and look at other reports. I'm not sure how many other members of the legislature do. And so I'm trying to, at least since the committee is interested in this particular one, you know, I'm specifically putting it. Sounds like there's no problems, and if we have to change some words in here to make it confirmed to reality.
Chair, we sent a lot of stuff over to Legislative Reference Library now that I assume nobody reads anyhow, and we'll send something else over.
But
I assume nobody will read.
Hey, this committee, Mr. Bicker, this committee is going to be different. they're going to get tests at the end of the at the end of each session as to how much they know about the stuff they're voting on.
Madam Chair, and to the witnesses just walking away, I want you to know legislators read a lot of those reports that are sent over to the legislature. We're the most mega nerds you can imagine. So on Friday and Saturday nights when other people are having fun, we read reports like that. We actually think they're interesting.
Okay. Any further discussion of the 5A amendment? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment passes. Okay. I think, is that... Oh, I had some questions to ask that I wanted to ask of PERA. Okay. Ms. Vanek, one of the things that puzzles me a little bit, and of course I'm the only person around, Mel, maybe Representative Sigum, when were you elected? What year were you elected?
Myself?
Yes.
78.
Okay, so Representative Sigum is then well accomplished. So he will remember this also. But in 1987, when we did the consolidation of all the police and fire into PERA, and I know you weren't the person who was there, but PERA was very, very I don't want to say, I think I can say opposed to this. They were very, very negative about doing this because of all of the things they were going to get into with having to deal with all of these very different local units of government. I think it's fair to say, and again, maybe Representative Sigham will back me up or contradict me, I think it's fair to say that it was passed over their, the consolidation was passed over their objections. So now suddenly we see this kind of very loose language about you're going to administer it and you're going to charge a fee. And I guess I'm kind of interested, what's caused the change in attitude? And I'm also interested in exactly what are you going to administer and what are you going to charge? And when are we going to know that?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mary Bannick. I'm the Executive Director of PERA. And you're right, I wasn't the director for the consolidation legislation, although I was the staff person who administered the 44 groups coming in. And I think that that is a very different perspective because we were in a situation where benefit differences between the local groups and our main plan were an issue of contention among the members of those plans and the members of our police and fire plan, and it was a challenge. The cost to administer those separate funds, because they required actuarial work every year and they required counseling of individual members, was much greater than this will be. But that being said, we successfully consolidated 44 groups, merged them into our police and fire plan, and things are going very well. This is different because we are collecting money from the city of Duluth and putting it into an account, keeping a record of it. The SBI will invest that money. We will keep track of the earnings on it, send them quarterly or semi-annual statements, yet to be determined what they prefer to receive from us. And when they need to take a withdrawal to make their payments for their post-retirement health insurance costs, we will simply cut a check through the state structure. It's minimal record keeping. Fortunately, computers have advanced significantly, so it's a very simple process. If Duluth is the only entity we do this for, we expect it will probably cost us a couple hundred dollars a year to do the record keeping and financial statements to accommodate what they need here.
Okay. Well, that then gives the question that I raised at some point, which is, why can't this just go through the State Board of Investment without going through PERA? So that's, you know, I don't have any... I do have an amendment, you know, we discussed this, Representative Huntley. I do have an amendment that does that, which I didn't author, because I didn't think we, well, because of kind of different testimony. But anyway, Mr. Bicker, what?
Madam Chair and members, you know, the State Board of Investment really doesn't administer any accounts. All we do is accept inflows and outflows, and really... somebody from Housing Finance needs some money, they just send it to us.
Okay.
What, as I understand it, PERA would do, they'll be in a position to also look at, verify whether this is an appropriate transfer of those assets. We are not in that business and we never have.
Okay. Now, why, going back one step, why can't Duluth just do that? Great. Ms. Stark.
Madam Chair, the reason Duluth can't do it is because the Governmental Accounting Standards Board statement, GASB number 45, requires it be in an irrevocable trust out of the management of the entity that it belongs to. We could actually keep the money ourselves, but then it wouldn't reduce the liability. It would increase an asset to offset the liability, but we couldn't say that the liability was reduced because it would still be within management's control.
Okay.
This takes it out of our control.
But to put the irrevocable trust into the State Board of Investment, why do you need it?
The irrevocable trust is not with us. It's with PERA.
Okay.
All I do is get the assets from PERA.
Madam Chair, and the other provision that confuses me then is that the City of Duluth is the trustee. I don't understand how you can create an irrevocable trust in PERA and then have the city serve as trustee.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's my understanding that this was an amendment that a previous House committee made, and it's because the City of Duluth has to tell the State Board of Investment which of their accounts to put it in. That's our only function, is to say which one to invest it in. And we are not, we cannot touch the money in the irrevocable trust. And our bill is actually structured based on the bill that was presented by the Office of the State Auditor last year, and they're the ones who set up the group bill to be this way, that all governments would have to go through PERA.
Madam Chair and members, again, there was some questions raised at the previous committee, and I think appropriately raised, in the sense that if the money was just sent to State Board of Investment, for example, without PERA or whatever, and the State Board of Investment determined the asset allocation or how that money should be invested, it really easily could be a transfer of liabilities to the state, because we have now made decisions for them that could affect the value of those assets they are transferring to the state. Duluth is retaining the responsibility to say how much risk they're willing to take with those assets, because ultimately it's Duluth's responsibility to make all the payments. So are they wanting to take high risk and have a high equity exposure or a low equity? Those are decisions that must be reached by the city administration. State Board of Investment's responsibility is only to implement their requests. Therefore, we do not potentially transfer some potential liability to the state for those liabilities out of the city of Duluth.
Madam Chair, and that makes sense. I guess then that because that begins to seem to sort of go against the grain of the GASB standard that you're trying to meet, number 45, I guess is my understanding. I just would like some, reassurance that even with the City of Duluth serving as trustee, the accounting standard would still be met.
Madam Chair and Representative, the accounting standard basically says they must put the liabilities on their books. What they're trying to do is reduce those liabilities through investment returns. Now, historically, the State Board of Investment, if you look at stocks and bonds and so on and so forth, a long period of time, returned 10-11%. Right now, they can invest those securities basically in short-term securities, which they are yielding 3-4%. Now, again, there's going to be variability in the returns if you're looking for longer-term assets, because we're going to have down years as well as up years. What they're looking at is over a 20-year period. If they can earn 8-10% versus 3-4%, you're discounting those liabilities, and by the time you discount those liabilities, instead of having a present value of $300 million, you get a present value of $150 million.
Madam Chair, thank you. The statement that I'm picking up on is that you have to create an irrevocable trust in some third party in order to satisfy the GASB standard. That's what I heard anyway. And so I'm wondering if doing it in such a way so that the City of Duluth is actually the trustee, you're satisfying that standard.
As I understand it, Madam Chair and Representative, PERA will actually control the distributions through the trust. If you don't have PERA or some independent party, then Duluth has the ability to put money in and take money out. And at that point in time, you're not meeting GASB requirements. You need that independent arbitrator in between to ensure that the money, especially leaving the trust, is for what it's supposed to be for. State Board of Investment is just kind of the third leg in the sense of the administrator having the money sent here.
Okay, thank you.
Any other representatives?
To the bill, Madam Chair?
Sure.
Madam Chair, first of all, Representative Huntley, I hope we speed up this bill and pass it next week. I think it's that important that we pass it right away. We should have passed it last spring. I think we did try to address it to some degree, but didn't get a couple things done at the end. To the couple of comments that were made on the bill, first of all, Gene, you had mentioned in your presentation $2 million a year to a rate increase. Were you talking about the rate of return increase at that point, or what rate increase were you talking about?
It's a rate increase on our utilities. Our water, gas, sewer, stormwater users are all paying varying increases to cover their share of the post-retirement benefit liability. The actuarial study attributed how much came from their retirees and their employees, and it's based on the current calculation, it's $2.3 million a year.
So it's
and
a utility rate.
It's a utility rate increase.
Okay. And I didn't catch the utility part.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think you said rate increase, and I was just wondering what the rate increase was.
It's a utility rate increase.
Okay. And secondly, Madam Chair, Mayor, I compliment you on being very proactive, being responsible in this legislation. Tough, I know. But to look to how we got there, Mayor, you were talking about the acceptance of a defined benefit plan to the defined contribution plan. I've always spoken about defined benefit, defined contribution in terms of pensions only. Were you speaking about pensions only, or were you speaking about this health care benefit too?
I'm actually speaking about the health care benefit only. In the two ratified contracts, we have one that's been ratified for several months for the supervisors unit. They went from the defined benefit, which was retiree health care until you hit Medicare age, to that plan three that was mentioned, which is which has much more exposure on the deductibles and copays. But the biggest part of it is that new hires will only get that defined contribution instead of health care until 65. And the defined contribution is, in that case, $12,000 on the third anniversary and nothing beyond that. And that $12,000 is put into a health care savings fund, and they can add to it with unused vacation time or comp time in the future. But the city no longer has any obligation to increase that fund for them. They let it grow with interest and additional contributions. In the case of the firefighters contract that the council is voting on tonight, which we expect to be ratified, their defined contribution will be $6,000 on the first anniversary date. So they're a little bit different, but in both cases we get away from the defined benefit, which is just too darn expensive to afford anymore.
But it's, Madam Chair, Mayor, it's only for new hires then?
Yes, but there were concessions made by going from Plan 4 to Plan 3. They're opening themselves up to, I think, about $2,500 in new deductibles every year, and then there's the additional copays that they don't have right now.
So is it true, Mayor, then, that there are still people working in the city someplace or another that would work as little as 3 years and still qualify for this full retired health benefit?
No. No.
Why do I read and see that there are individuals who work for the city as little as 3 years that qualify for the full health retirement? I've read that someplace.
Because that's how it used to be. It's in the last contract, we got that out. There's now a gradual, I guess what you'd call a ladder, that a person gets a percentage for each year of service, and they have to actually have 20 years to get the full benefit now.
That's a step in the right direction. I know you're dealing with union contracts and negotiations, and there are only certain things you can do. I understand that. But from a prudent, responsible standpoint, what was granted and given a few years ago, before yourself, Mayor, as you know, completely not prudent, completely inappropriate. And I know that you and the city are, taxpayers are paying the price for that. I understand that, but I understand you're doing what you can, but I would like to see also a little more aggressive action. It's a huge problem, and thank you for doing what you're doing. Thank you for being responsible. And I know that you have a consequence here that you weren't really the determiner of, and I just compliment you.
Thank you, and just know that I know we're still not to where other municipalities or firms of government or even the private sector is, but the concessions that we've been able to get were with a lot of angst and a lot of hard feelings, and pretty significant compared to what's been done, which is nothing over the last 23 years.
To take back what should have never been given, isn't it?
Okay. We do have a department here who wants to continue, but I don't want to cut off any debates, but if we are ready to pass this on, I would like to. Are there any other comments or questions from any other committee members? Okay, the chair removes renews the motion that House File 163. We recommend it to pass and go back to the Committee on Finance as amended.
Madam Chair, quick question to that motion. Why does it have to go to Finance again?
I don't know.
Come on, there's no state funding. There's no state money in this, correct?
Well, because it can't, it's in Finance.
Oh, it's
it only
in Finance.
Gets sent it was to only us. And so it needs to, Finance needs to send it
out. Too many
it
committees, out. Madam Chair.
Mr. Speaker Emeritus, I was not asked.
That's old.
I was not asked to set up the committee.
So, Madam Chair, if I amend your motion and send it to the floor, we can't
I
do that?
I don't think so. No, we can't because it's not here. We don't have it. We own it. Finance really has it. And hopefully Finance gets it. What?
Okay.
What? We're a division. We're not a committee. And so the
I won't add my other comments.
And so I hope it gets
two more dollars from Mr. Hunter.
And so I hope it gets out of Finance without anyone paying any attention, doing anything else with it. But out of my hands. Okay. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thanks for the really good explanation. Okay, Mr. Hansen, Department of Finance.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of Finance. Thank you for having us here today. We often show up at other committees talking about other people's budgets, but we don't often get to talk about our own. I have, in my time working around the legislature, found the work by this committee some of the more interesting committees around. Your finance bills are always a must-read for me whenever they come out for pleasure reading as well as necessity. Today I am going to, our presentation is going to take part in three parts. I'm going to provide you with an overview, talk about our mission, our what we do, our accomplishments, and briefly talk about our organization chart. Our Deputy Commissioner Stephanie Andrews, to my left, will walk through in a little more detail what our agency does. And then finally our Assistant Commissioners will walk through the three budget items. And, of course, we're available for questions anytime you want. We are essentially, many of you are familiar with some of the, a lot of the work we do. We are the state's financial advisors, accountants, and budget preparers. Most of you are familiar with our budget preparation services. You see the budget prepared and delivered by the, that we provide for the governor that he delivers, as well as our supplemental budget. You see the economic update forecast for November, and what, as well as in February, as well as our revenue updates and our economic quarterly updates. That's a portion of what we do. We are responsible for also accurately presenting and reporting the state's financial condition. We have a whole division in our agency that are accountants that report every transaction, prepare the financial reports of our agency. We provide advice to the legislature and as well as the governor. It's our goal to improve the accountability and promote the prudent use of our state resources so we get the most out of our dollars. I think we're all in agreement on that. And it's our goal to ensure the integrity and the sound use of the state's financial resources. Some of the things we do, we're responsible for managing the state's, for this biennium, $51 billion budget. It's 51 because of the special revenue accounts. The general fund is $32 million for the current biennium. And in the next biennium, the one we're going to be budgeting for, that overall $51 billion number will go up to about $55 billion. We provide budget advice to agencies, legislators, and the governor. We are the we pay 50,000 state employees biweekly. We manage 133 funds aside from the general fund through 5,100 separate accounts. We conduct two annual bond sales. We produce the two forecasts that you see annually, as well as quarterly economic updates. We prepare Minnesota's financial statements and federal compliance report. And we manage financial transactions totaling $344 billion, including investment and reinvestment activity. And finally, we provide statewide administrative systems application and support to over 6,000 users at 130 state agencies. I have found in my month there, I've worked with, in my time in the governor's office as well as when I was here at the legislature, I had worked with some of the senior level people, but I had not gotten to know the rest of the agency, and I have been doing that in the last month and have found that they are mostly long-term employees. I met a gentleman the other day who's been doing the same job for 35 years. When he started at the agency, Nixon was running against McGovern, and the guy was as enthusiastic about his job when I saw him as I'm sure he was back then. We have some of our accomplishments. We have received the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting from the Government Finance Officers Association for 20 consecutive years. The Department of Finance has received unqualified audit opinions from the Legislative Auditor for the past 21 years. Our state bonds are rated at AAA by Standard & Poor's and Fitch, and AA1, the second highest rating by Moody's. We have a state financial management rating of A- by Governing Magazine for February 2005, as well as a B, which would be nice if it was better, for state capital management by Governing Magazine for February 2005. The agency, for a long time, long before I was there, has been well managed, whether it has been under Governor Ventura, Governor Carlson, or Governor Perpich. I'm just fortunate enough to have inherited some fairly qualified people. And then finally,
I put a quick question in there, Nair.
Sure.
When did the ratings, who's under whose administration and who was in charge of the House when the ratings from Moody went down?
Who was in charge of the House?
Yes.
I don't remember, Madam.
Okay.
I think it was the, do you want me to answer that?
Yes.
It yeah, was sure. In...
This is rhetorical, Nair.
It was in 2003.
Okay.
The organizational chart that I think was handed out, you see who our agency is, the commissioners, myself. You will see the four divisions. We have three assistant commissioners, a deputy commissioner, and our state economist. I would like to point out that the and emphasize the point that it is an agency of professionals that many of long-term service in our state. The four senior people, three of them were there under Governor Ventura when Pam Wheelock was finance commissioner. And the fourth, our assistant commissioner, state budget director Jim Showalter, was with the agency and got promoted to budget director when Peggy Ingerson got promoted to commissioner in our administration. So it has been a fairly stable organization. Our deputy commissioner, Stephanie Anders, has been with the agency 14 years. I'm the newbie on the block. With that, I will turn it over to Stephanie.
Any general questions for Commissioner Hanson? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Stephanie Anders, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Finance. I just want to take a couple minutes to walk you through in a little more detail the different divisions in the department, as Commissioner Hanson just talked about. For general orientation, our base budget for finance, all funds for 2008 and 2009 is $44 million. Basically a base budget of $30 million in general fund with a governor's recommendation taking that up to $37.7 million, the largest piece of which is a $7 million request for some contingency funding for our statewide accounting and procurement systems, and you'll hear about that in some more detail as we go forward. The other piece...
If I could, Commissioner, to that, that's a one-time funding. Is it not that MAPS funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Sweetum, that's correct.
Okay. for the statewide accounting system procurement system?
That's correct. It's one-time funding, although obviously there's a big piece that's the first piece of it that you would see. We would be coming back in the next couple of years to request the entire amount.
Second phase of it?
To request the whole system, yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Swigum, it's akin to some of the cars you drive. They're really, it's kind of old, and it's probably going to give out at some point, but it still works.
Madam Chair, we'll talk about the creaky system in more detail as we go forward here so that you can understand. The other important piece.
It's like Swigum's car, does it need to be washed also?
Madam Chair, that's dirt and dust that holds it together.
Madam Chair, I'll take just having the inside interior roof sewn up.
Okay, enough analogies. Let's go on.
Madam Chair, members, just to point out the other piece of the department's funding that you don't talk about or see as much is $13.7 million in statutory billing authority. Where finances the authority is given the authority by law to bill other agencies for the maintenance and operations of the accounting and payroll systems. So just to go through, if you have the detailed budget documents in front of you, you'll see from the early pages of that budget presentation, basically the different divisions that the commissioner talked about. Our Treasury Division, headed by Assistant Commissioner Peter Sousen, who he can't be with us here today, but he's actually up in Duluth, which would we'll talk about a little bit more as we talk about the Bankruptcy Council request. But that division is largely made up of members from the former Office of the State Treasurer that, as you may remember, a constitutional amendment was passed, I think in 1999, that abolished the office as of 2003, and those folks came to join our department. That division provides cash management functions. It establishes banking services for state agencies, accesses capital markets to provide financing for capital projects after you pass bonding bills, and administers the state's tax-exempt bonding allocation. That's about 9% of our budget and 12 FTEs in all. The Economic Analysis Unit, you're also pretty familiar with the primary product that they produce, which is the state revenue and expenditure forecasts in November and February, headed up by Dr. Tom Stinson. Not all of you are perhaps aware that Dr. Tom Stinson is actually a contractor with the Department of Finance, actually still a faculty member at the University of Minnesota. That is 2% of our budget and 3 FTEs. Again, pretty high visibility for those three folks. And obviously they set the baseline for all the work that we do and you do on the budget. Budget Services, headed by State Budget Director Jim Showalter, works to coordinate the production of the governor's operating and capital budgets, assists legislative committees in review of legislation and preparation of fiscal notes, working with agencies then after the budget is enacted to actually implement their budgets, providing spending oversight throughout the year. There are 21 FTEs in that division, and it makes up about 11% of our agency budget. The Accounting Services Division, one of the largest, one of the two largest of our agency, headed by Assistant Commissioner Lori Moe. This division administers the payroll and accounting systems, reports on the state's financial condition. You may be familiar with the state's Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, more commonly known as the CAFR. That's prepared in accordance with GAAP, that one of the major products that they produce. They also help, again, on an ongoing basis, agencies manage their financial activities throughout the year. This area accounts for 24% of our budget and 54 FTEs. And finally, actually, the largest proportion of our budget, the Information Services Division. They provide technical support to our administrative information system, including the MAP system, which, again, the Accounting and Procurement System is what the acronym stands for. We'll talk more about that. The data warehouse, accessed by all state agencies to understand their accounting and administrative activities, and the statewide employee management system, Semaphore, which is the system which provides the payroll for all of our state employees. They also provide support for our budget information systems, which your fiscal staff are familiar with in terms of how we actually produce the governor's budget and reflect the agency's activities. They also support Treasury investment applications and the agency computer network and infrastructure. That's 27% of our budget and 48 FTEs. And finally, then, all of that is supported and supports the management services
group, which provides human resources and administrative support for the agency. That's about 8% of the budget and 12 FTEs. If there aren't any questions on the general overview, we want to move to discussion of the change items that the governor's budget is recommending.
Any discussion? Okay.
The first of those items, Madam Chair, can be found on page 12 of your detailed budget documents if you have those in front of you. It's a request for $315,000 of one-time funding in fiscal year 2008 to pay for bankruptcy counsel. Basically, as you know, Northwest Airlines filed for bankruptcy in September of 2005. At that time, the Department of Finance and the Department of Revenue, the IRRR, and the City of Duluth met with the Attorney General and discussed the need to obtain outside counsel to help move forward with to protect the state and city interests. At that time, they estimated that the overall cost of this activity was going to be $500,000. And we basically, this $315,000 is a request for a portion of that $500,000. Since we started this activity, Finance, Revenue, and IRRR have contributed money from their own budgets. We also received from the 2006 legislature an appropriation for $325,000. Basically, what we are now finding is that we're assuming that the bankruptcy action will continue into fiscal year 2008, and we need the money to continue into the next fiscal year.
Okay. Any questions on this?
Madam Chair, I think the next thing that we're going to talk about is State Budget Director Jim Showalter will come up to talk about the compensation adjustment for the agency and carry forward. Mr. Showalter.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director, and we're pleased to present a couple of the change items in the department's budget. The first one is the compensation adjustment of $259,000 in 2008 and $523,000 in 2009. Part of the reason I'm presenting it is that this is a familiar page that you will become familiar with it as you roll through other agencies' budget requests. The format and the way in which this is calculated is consistent across nearly all agencies with a couple of modest exceptions. The approach has been that in our budget instructions, we recommended to state agencies that they anticipate about a 3.25% increase in total compensation costs. That 3.25% increase is, again, on all costs associated with employment, not just salaries. That would include insurance, health and benefits, other related costs. The amount that's recommended in the governor's budget is at 2%. That is in the general fund. To the extent that there are other agencies that have non-general fund operating costs, to the extent that those funding sources were able to support those costs, a amount up to 3.25% was recommended. The other major exception in this approach was for direct care services, primarily those where we have labor-intensive activities that really have very little opportunity to either substitute or change inputs. That would include correctional guards, veterans homes, as well as state operated services. Is there any questions on that particular item?
Anyone? Okay.
The next item I would like to bring to your attention is within the finance non-operating area.
I guess I have a question on
Certainly.
That. If you allow the adjustment for the special funds of up to 3.25%, isn't that a tacit admission that the general fund of 2% is not enough?
Madam Chair, members, I think it is, as always, a question of resources. To the extent that that fund did not have the resources or that there were other priorities that we chose to put those resources towards, that increase wouldn't have been at 3.25%. So I think it's just, again, a question of relative priorities. Part of the general fund budget also includes a number of technology investments that are intended to help find ways for state agencies to approach costs in different ways. Continuing into finance non-operating, I will just to draw your attention real briefly to the program narrative that explains some of the core functions that are in the finance non-operating portion of the budget. That's on page 20 of the Department of Finance. These elements are not elements of how we pay for our operating expenses. These are not part of the direct appropriations that the legislature makes to the department. However, they are clearing accounts, types of activities that are statutorily expected and required of the department to make things work, essentially. And there's a number of different activities that are included in this. For change pages, there is one request that is included in the finance non-operating area, and that relates to carry forward of funds, operating funds. Currently, state statute allows for operating funds appropriated to state agencies to be carried forward from the first year of the biennium into the second year. At the end of that second year, statute requires that that money be canceled back to the general fund. We, in our forecast, estimate some cancellation of those funds back to the general fund, and then those are available for general appropriations and general use going forward. The recommendation here is to change that statute so that essentially those monies are available for technology purposes, or and that they're transferred into a special revenue fund so that agencies have control of those funds to make necessary investments going into the future. At question here is helping to make sure that the incentives for wise use of those funds and efficient use of those funds is maintained throughout the year, throughout the course of the biennium. This issue goes back over a long period of times where there's a sort of a use it or lose it mentality going towards the end of a biennium. Not suggesting that people are wasting funds or anything like that, but you can rush projects, you can do things that are maybe coming before their time. And to the extent that we are able to find ways to smooth out the financing mechanism, hopefully we could help the effectiveness of the state overall.
Any questions about that? Okay.
If there's no questions associated with that, I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Lori Moe.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Lori Moe. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Accounting Services Division of the Department of Finance, and I'd like to talk to you today about the final change item, the $7 million request for the MAPS risk mitigation and replacement planning. If you're following along in your budget materials, it's on page 17. Just a little background to start. Again, the MAPS acronym stands for the Minnesota Accounting and Procurement System. It's the accounting and purchasing system used by all of the agencies statewide, and it's an essential tool for managing our resources and for meeting the state's obligations. The system was installed back in 1995. It's currently stable and reliable, but it is aging, and we're approaching the time for system replacement. The only upgrade that's been done to this system since it was installed was in 1998, which was a technical upgrade to solve the year 2000 issue, and there has been no upgrade since then. And we have started steps towards planning for its replacement, and we need to continue those activities in the coming year to prepare for the replacement. And the balance of the funds is for risk mitigation to address any problems that may come up with the system until it is replaced. Of the $7 million request, $500,000 is for the planning component of the change item. We have done considerable work over the last couple of years in preparing for the eventual system replacement, including complete documentation of the current business processes, and some visualization of how those processes can be improved. And we have compiled a list of over 2,500 system requirements. There are, however, a number of steps that still need to be completed before we would go ahead, be ready to go ahead with a project for system replacement. The remaining $6.5 million is for risk mitigation. it would be contingency funding that would be spent only if problems arose that threatened system operation, and would be spent only if needed for that purpose. The system is an aging client server technology that's growing increasingly incompatible with the technology that surrounds it. As desktop computing standards advance and as mainframe computing standards change, the system is increasingly incompatible on both sides of the spectrum. And to address the 2 years ago, we did a comprehensive risk assessment and identified the possible risk to the system as well as a number of mitigation strategies. And in the event of a problem, we would, of course, use the lowest cost effective solution first. But as the system ages and as other technology changes around us, the risks grow and it may become necessary to resort to the higher cost solution. So the risk mitigation, the $6.5 million of the change item is only for those steps if they were needed to avoid a system failure. We have been very successful in maintaining high availability of the system over the past years, and that's been possible through careful monitoring and thorough testing of any changes that get made to the system. And we will continue to do that, but this funding will allow us to take those additional steps if they become necessary to address system changes. Are there questions?
I have one, which is, is there any committee members have any questions? I have a question. The question I have is just focusing on the line that where you say the analysis showed that the best approach for the state of Minnesota is to replace the components of the existing system with commercially available, broadly supported software. Remembering back to 1994, somebody whom I am very well connected with actually made that suggestion at that time. And what changed the analysis between 1994, where one went with this completely customized system, as opposed to what to now, trying to decide the things that some people had suggested in 1994.
Madam Chair,
I'm looking at a set of people who are around. You know, when I can't, I like best for things to go well. When they don't go well, I really like to assign fault. So it's frustrating to not see anybody around to assign fault to. But
Madam Chair, I'll give you a history I know on what happened and some of the differences that I think we have today. Back when the system was selected in the early 90s, the decision was made that the best solution for the accounting and procurement module came from different vendors. And so part of the major customization in installing the system that we have today was building an interface between those two modules, and maintaining that interface over the years has been a major part of system maintenance. But those two functions are highly integrated, and a fully integrated system delivered from the vendor apparently was unavailable to meet the needs in both components. Our hope and our research in the recent months is that the products that are available today have evolved considerably since the early 90s, and the level of customization, not only in the interface but in other areas, would be considerably reduced. It is a challenge, though, to install a system without customization. To do one without any modifications at all likely will mean that some of the functionality, some of the business practices that people have grown accustomed to will have to change. And the modifications that we have put in place will not necessarily be available in the delivered
process.
Madam Chair, I'd like to go to the risk mitigation, the $6.5 million. So as I understand it, those funds are in case something potentially drastic happens to the system and basically melts down or ceases to function in some critical way. And in that case, you would have money available to take emergency action as needed. Is that essentially what it's for?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, the... so then presumably sort of your current ongoing maintenance and service requirements are covered in your base budget, and so there's a good possibility that if something major doesn't happen, all $6.5 million would be sitting there for when it comes time to implement the new system.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be my hope. But let me add that the need to be prepared to address system problems would continue during the implementation period for a new system, and we expect that to be approximately a 24-month period. So it would be my hope that when we implemented a new system that, yes, that this none of these funds would have been spent and would be about to cancel back to the general fund.
And do you have a timeline for when you're expect to begin implementation? I know that the $500,000 is to continue to analyze and discover, you know, to determine the best path. But do you have any kind of dates in mind for when you're going to be done or even begin?
Madam Chair, Representative, we are currently estimating an 18 to 24 month project and would expect to schedule that for a conversion at the end of a fiscal year. So it would be 2 years out from approval of a funding request for system replacement. What this planning funds will do will have us prepared to come forward with a funding request. And when those decisions will be made, I'm not certain.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I would assume no later than in the next biennial budget we would probably be coming forward with a replacement plan.
Okay.
And to your previous question, you know, if this money is not used, it can hopefully roll into that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Mr. Hanson, I actually have a question for you. No, I know it's a funny question to ask finance because you're kind of the arm.
Trying to slip out.
I know, you're kind of the arm of the governor to do. But did you ask, in your recommendations that you gave for finance to the governor, which is kind of your recommendations to yourself, is there anything that you had in those recommendations that the governor did not support?
Is there anything the governor did not support in the
recommendations? When your agency prepared your proposal to the governor, which is funny because it's your proposal to you, is there anything that you or that after the governor looked over your shoulder, he did not support in what you had asked for?
Well, that's kind of a difficult question because it's...
I know. Don't you come here because you want difficult questions?
Oh, I know. I expected you'd throw one at me, Madam Chair, based on your past history. When it was with our department, it was more. We talked about it, and I don't think there was ever one point to use the words "I don't support that." We gradually came to the recommendations that you see in front of you.
Okay.
Finance, did you ask for the full funding of the MAPS replacement as opposed
to
what you've gotten?
We discussed, and what we did with our computer, with all of our technology needs and requests, and I know that you went on Gopal Khanna's, he probably walked through those with you. We talked about this, you know, our agency's needs in the context of everything else. And then we prioritized, and this particular project, in light of everything else, was prioritized out of the budget.
But, okay. Madam Chair, would you be unhappy if we decided that you should have full funding?
Madam Chair, if I might, I think that one of the ways to think about the process with our agencies and others, and in this sense, finance is no different than any other agencies, similar also to what you do. We start out broad with a whole set of ideas that agencies have, and as we go through the iterative process of the governor's budget decision-making, we talk about what the right things, where the right places to end up, and certainly MAPS is a good example of that, where we talk about, you know, if all the money in the world was there, where would you go? It's obviously a project that's had a lot of thought put into it, and it's on a good track. We could speed up. We could slow down. I think that the recommendation you have in front of you reflects the fact that we think that we can move ahead for a couple more years and then come back and ask for it in 2 years. But we could adjust that depending on how you respond to that.
If we decided you should speed up, would that eliminate some of the need for the risk mitigation funding?
Madam Chair, I think as Commissioner Mo talked about, throughout the planning and implementation process of the new system, there's still a need for contingency funds. We still have a system that we need to keep in place until the new one's ready to go. So I'm not comfortable saying that we don't need those. Obviously, the sooner we get that in place, the less, the sooner we might be able to cancel it back, but there's still some need for contingency funds whenever we do it.
Okay. Madam Chair, just to follow up, when I looked at the recommendations, my role of managing the Department of Finance, yeah, you bet I wanted it in. But when I, you know, when we went to and we talked at the governor's office, prioritized everything else and looked at the security, the security initiative and all the other technology initiatives, as well as things beyond the purview of your committee, K-12 funding and everything, you know, we came up with a number for technology, and then this was prioritized out. It is a big, as you know, a big dollar amount, and we were able to fund a lot of other much-needed technology projects. And that all was in the mix. So it was a difficult decision.
Representative Winston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, there are a number of, I know, that, for example, in the K-12 system, and the Department of Education is interested in replacing its own financial software, and it's essentially dependent on MAPS kind of going forward first, so they know what they need to build towards. And that's a particular interest of mine. And it seems to me that in a budget year where we have significant one-time money available, technology is one of the areas that is logical to invest that. And I guess, so the question is, one, do you have a sense of what the overall replacement cost is going to be? And two, if you had the funds, could you move to it quickly? Or would it, or how long before you could get going?
Laurie, you can come up and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the total, the initial estimate with contingency costs was $58 million. If you take out the contingency and do the, I guess, calling it the bare bones, maybe could do it for $45 million, but then you better hope that there's nothing that goes wrong, or you would need to come back.
Ms. Mulvey, you have been.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Hansen's $58 million numbers was our original estimate, and as he said, with contingency, over time, that may change. What we expect to do is a competitive process, and hope that we will come in within that.
And, Madam Chair, if you found a way to fund it and did everything else we'd put in our budget and not raise taxes, I'd be fine. So.
But we got a couple of printing presses, and maybe an old car that know how to do
that'd
that.
That'd be a perfect world.
And you said, however, that you could get going right away if the money was available.
We have had, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we have had a team of 100 and 120, 130 individuals across state government working on this project for the last year or so.
So if we did this whole thing, we could then, in the next year, get rid of 130 people?
Well, they do other things.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yes. Meeting is adjourned.